This is 4:55 on Friday, November 4th. Good morning. Today we're going to, of course, do the exam review. I want to finish up Chapter 5, talking about virtualized link layers. And then I just want to mention something that Michael came into my office and asked about in problem 8 of the assignment. Remember in problem, well, maybe you don't remember, but I'll explain. In figuring out the efficiency of the Aloha protocol, we came up with this formula NP times 1 minus p to the n minus 1 as the probability that some sender succeeds, right? In Aloha. Right, that was what we came up with. We talked about it on the slide. We didn't ever actually solve it. And then in this problem, you're asked to say, okay, so given a fixed n, what value of p maximizes that formula? Right, because you want to choose a probability that will give you the best chance of success. And as Michael observed, the technique you use, of course, is to differentiate with respect to p, set it to zero, and solve for p. Right? And then that will either be a maximum or a minimum, and then you compare that to the extremes of p, which are 0 and 1, which, of course, can't be the answer because those both give you zero. So there we go. So the problem here is that differentiating this thing looks like a real pain in the you know what. But there's a little trick that says let q equals 1 minus p and rewrite. Then it's n times 1 minus q times q, too many parentheses, q to the n minus 1, right? And that looks a lot more tractable for differentiation. So you solve for the q that maximizes this formula and then calculate p from that. Does that make sense to everybody? So that avoids a whole lot of stuff about chain rules and other things that you don't have otherwise, especially after you realize that you can first of all, it doesn't depend on n, so that goes away. So we're asked to maximize 1 minus q times q to the n minus 1. You might think, oh, I still need the multiplication rule, but no, because you can just multiply that out. What is that? Q to the n minus 1 minus q to the n. And so, then it's really easy to differentiate. And set to zero and so on and so forth. Okay, so that was just a little observation there. This goes back a long ways for me. When I was taking a numerical analysis class, I was given a programming problem. So this was many, many years ago. I was given a programming problem that was sort of unstable for numerical solution as expressed directly, but by a change of variable like this, it was a little more complicated than this. It would involve taking a logarithm or something. It turned into something that was sort of perfectly stable and easy to solve, and course, nobody in the class saw this. So I like to point out this when I get a chance, is that often something that looks really ugly in one format with a change of variable will resolve itself into something that's much more tractable to work with. So just something to have in your bag of tricks when dealing with numerical stuff. Any questions? All right, so we'll quickly finish up network virtualization using this one. Yes. So when this book was written a few years ago, I don't think everybody was as familiar with virtualization as they are now, right? The popularity of VMware and VirtualBox and QEMU and so forth on the Linux and Windows platforms have really made people much more aware of virtualization as a technique. So those are all about virtualizing machines, but we can use virtualization in the networking as well by essentially building links out of higher level networking stuff. So, there. So in some sense, you can think of the whole idea of the IP layer as being a virtualization of the idea of a link, right? The idea of a link is to take hosts from... Take packets from one host and deliver them to another host, right? And the internet is just a virtualization of that that lets that happen over a long distance. So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is to say, I have a completely alien networking technology. Like ATM. Remember, we just keep mentioning ATM. Remember, it's this virtual circuity networking technology built by the phone company, working on fixed size cells of 48 bytes that seems like a really crazy idea. But the telephone companies wanted it. It got built. Now it has certain advantages in terms of switching, because everything's the same size in ATM, so the circuits for dealing with it are better than the circuits for dealing with IP packets, which vary in size from 40 bytes up to 1500 or so. So ATM is a network, but it is used in the internet as a virtual link layer. Right? So you can plug in an ATM virtual circuit between two points and have all the traffic inserted at one end show up at the other end. So regardless of what happens in the middle, the perspective from the IP layer is it's just a link. Right. So that's... So what is ATM... late 80s, more 90s standard for high-speed integrated service phone company stuff, right? The idea was to meet the quality of service requirements for different kinds of traffic within a single network. And remember, the internet doesn't do that. The internet has this best effort service model that is what it is, you take it or leave it. And ATM really tried to say, There are different applications. We need to have different classes of service to support them. And ATM is what they came up with. So it's expensive. It never took off in the local area networks. We worked on that at Xerox PARC for several years, and it was, in the end, a bad idea. So, but in the wide area, in a sort of continental scale, ATM is very popular because you can get a lot of traffic going over fibers. You can separate the traffic into different sort of service classes and deal with it separately. Yeah.
Is this going to be on the test?
No.
No. Okay.
This is background.
I mean, like any of the stuff we're covering today, not just that.
Well, we're gonna review for the exam shortly, and that will be on the test.
Right. I was just wondering if like this was going to be on it too, or if this was going to be on the next one.
No, this is just background. This is a freebie. It's a freebie. I don't want to talk about it. I really don't want to talk about most of this. You can read about it in the book. Right? So, it's just what I said. You have an ATM network. It connects things, but from the IP layer, it looks like a link. That's enough to say. MPLS, we're not going to talk about that. Chapter 5 summary. What did we talk about? We talked about error detection and correction. We talked about multiple access protocols. I'm going to talk about this in the context of the exam. And we talked about link layer addressing, in particular ARP. We talked about the Ethernet protocol primarily, and we talked about the MAC, the medium access control protocol associated with Ethernet, and we talked about sort of the idea of medium sharing in general. And this was a freebie. All right, well, where are we going from here? We're going to talk about wireless a bit. We're going to talk about security mostly between now and the end of the semester. Those are the main things that are left. If we have time, we'll say a little bit about multimedia, but we're not going to say much about network management, especially in the form that they talk about it in this book. It's way more complicated issue than what they talk about in the book. So that's where we're headed. Wireless next, and then security. Okay. So the exam. For the previous exam in this class, did I give you one sheet of notes? Yeah, we'll do that again. One sheet of notes. And it's Monday, November 7th. That could really throw things in the... So Monday, November 7th, that's 3 days from now. Will be the exam, one sheet of notes, a calculator. Again, I don't necessarily think a calculator is needed, but you may, so bring one if you'd like. And no other electronic stuff, phones or computers or anything like that. And it will be 50 minutes starting at 10:10. You know, the usual stuff. No, nothing new there. Wednesday, November 9th, no class. And Friday, November 11th, is a holiday. So I will see you a week from Monday. So let's talk about the exam. First thing to do is here. So we're here. What we're covering is, don't forget, we actually didn't cover congestion control on the first exam. So we go back to congestion control, and then we do the network layer and the lake layer chapters. I did. I tried. Apparently I missed, or failed to do the last step or something. Let's do this. And I also have some audio recordings yet to post that I will do today before I go home. So those will be there. So anyway, all right. Well, this unfortunately doesn't give a very clear picture of what is in those chapters and what the topics of greatest issue are. So let's do this. Congestion control. So usually with congestion control, there are just a couple of things that will sort of give you the information that you need. It isn't simple. It's complicated, but I think having bogus in the first case. So that's the picture that is the thing that, if you know everything about that picture, you will know a great deal about congestion control, not quite everything. So the names of the phases, what's that one, which is also known as slow start, right? All right. Those things are called, the vertical bars are multiplicative decrease, right? Where you cut things in half and then go on from there. This one, where you go all the way back down to one, MSS. That's the timeout, right? This is the three missed acts, three repeated acts, an act. What's it called? The receipt of three duplicate acts. So it's four acts for the same packet. The third duplicate. And then a timeout takes you back down to one and puts you into slow start again. But you grow to
half of what the previous one was.
So the point that you would have gone to if you had if you had done a half, that becomes the threshold, the slow start threshold for the future. Okay, so that, you know, knowing that diagram just really gives you a...
What's after the slow start? So you have slow start, step change, growth. What's that?
This is additive increase. Okay. And remember, the scale here is not in packets, but in essentially round trip times.
And then the window size is the y-axis, right?
And the window, the congestion window size is the y-axis. Okay? So that's one aspect of things, is that diagram. Second aspect of things is what actual window size does the sender use? Right? It has to take into account two things. It has to take into account the behavior of the network. It also has to take into account the receiver's capabilities. Right? So the minimum of the congestion window and the receiver's window. So that's cool.
Wouldn't the receiver's window, if it was too small and you were giving it too much, cause drop or three duplicate acts and then lower the congestion window?
No. The receiver tells the sender its receive window size.
Right.
Right? So the sender actually knows the receiver's window size.
Right.
Okay. It's the network that we're having to figure out. So we know the receiver's window size. Okay, another thing about congestion control is sort of related to what we talked about with the receiver window size. So part of what we can do now that we couldn't do before is we can package up this whole story about window sizes and performance. Right? So you have to remember about the receiver window size as well, and you have to remember about the performance. How big does the window have to be in order to make full use of the network bandwidth? That's an important one. Anyone? To have good utilization of the network, how big does the window have to be? Has to be the bandwidth delay product, right? Right. Okay, so that's relevant here, even though we didn't talk about it in this sort of third of the class very much, because that's going to interact with congestion control and the receiver window size. Let's see. What else? Oh, the other thing to keep in mind . Remember this diagram? What is this diagram showing us?
Oh, it's the fairness.
Right. This is the diagram that shows you that TCP congestion control tends to drive you toward a fair allocation of resources between multiple senders. This is the sender one window size. This is the sender two window size. Okay, so that says we tend to drive toward equal window sizes, and that doesn't directly tell you that it's fair. You also have to remember that the window size is proportional to the bandwidth. used. And we went through an argument about how that worked. Okay. That's the congestion control piece. And I think there were some problems in the homework that dealt with that. Pardon? No. So just review the problems. Okay, then networks. This is chapter 4. We talked about network addressing. So we talked about IPv4 addresses, subnet addresses, subnet masks, so just as an example, here's a question that I asked once upon a time. Host address 13.2.0.64 mask subnet mask 255.252.0. And I asked how many bits of the host address represent the subnet and how many represent the host address within the subnet. What are you looking at to determine that? You look at the mask, exactly. And the mask has turned on the bits that correspond to the subnet and turned off the bits that correspond to the host. And so how many bits is it? Well, it's easier to look from this end. Right? There's 8 bits there for the host, a whole byte of zeros, and you're missing 3 to take you up to 2, the value 3, which is 2 bits, to take you up to 255. So it's 8 plus 2 bits of 0 is 10 bits of host. And if there are 10 bits of host, then there are 22 bits of subnet. And remember that the other way to express this is by writing 22 with a slash notation. It says the subnet part is 22 bits and the...
Wait, I missed the 22. Because you have 8 from the...
We have 10 for the host.
Sure, okay.
Okay, and there are 32 total, so 22 is left. There's 32 bits total.
Okay.
10 bits here for the host, so 22 for the subnet. Okay. Okay. DHCP, what does it do? What does it stand for? And what does it do? It's a dynamic host configuration protocol, and it's a way for a host to get an address without, when it starts out not having one. Okay. Then we talked about routing. We talked about longest prefix matches. This was actually more forwarding than routing. The idea of the longest prefix match is to have a routing table with varying numbers of bits for each entry, and when you get a packet, you find the longest matching one. Okay, so that's fine. And why would we do that? Well, make sure you understand. That was forwarding. Routing. We have distance vector and link state algorithms. A typical problem, exam problem, for distance vector is given a current routing table and an update from a neighbor. Tell me the new routing table. Because after all, that's how distance vector works, right? You have your current routing table, you get some new information from one of the adjacent routers, and you update your table. Right? So how does that work? That's a typical problem for that. For link state, you know, given a network, fill in the table. Okay, remember this table? So N prime is the list of nodes that you have a complete solution for. And DA and D of a node and P of a node are the current estimate of the distance to a node and the current predecessor of that node, in which you then sort of reverse the predecessor links in order to get the actual route. Okay, so filling in that sort of table is a typical link state problem. CRC computations, given a generator and a message, compute the checksum. It's a typical problem there. So what do you need to know to do that? You need to know how the what a generator is, right? Which I will give you that, saying here's the generator. You need to know how many bits are going to be in the checksum. That's pretty basic, right? And you need to know the process by which you go from the generator and the message to the correct checksum, right? Which, as you will recall, was sort of a representation of polynomial division with binary coefficients. Yes?
By the length of the checksum, do you mean, are you going to be telling us how much it's supposed to be? Are we using a certain algorithm?
It depends on the generator.
Oh.
Okay? given a generator, you know what the length of the checksum is supposed to be. Yeah?
Is it okay if we convert to base 10, divide, and then convert back to binary, or do you want us to do all the division on the test?
It won't work.
Oh, okay.
No. It doesn't work because you're not doing binary division, you're doing polynomial division.
Oh, okay.
Right?
I was thinking of for the remainder for different problems.
Yeah, okay. No. For this one, you really have to do it binary. You have to do it binary polynomial division. Or you get the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Right. So, I would be misleading you if I told you you could use decimal division. Yeah, Matt.
From chapter 4, you don't have anything on
Not beyond the just general idea of that I think we actually did in chapter 1 already, of when does congestion occur? Okay. What is congestion? Right, it's queues, full queues, right, causing packets to be dropped, and that becomes the signal to TCP for congestion control. Yeah. All right. And, of course, parity, which is just so easy that, you know, you need to know the terminology, but the computation is easy enough. Okay, so that's what I give in the way of an exam for this material. And that's pretty much everything that we talked about in this. It's amazing how you can take 5 weeks of lectures and compress them down to about 10 bullets, but well, that's ARP, yeah.
That will be on there.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Time-wise, we're okay. Any?
Is there a sample exam?
No, there's not a sample exam. Sorry. I'll see what I can do, but no promises. Yeah, man.
So, I kind of had this question on the homework, too. But
uh-huh.
I was going to ask you. So, when you have... when you're doing CRC
mm-hmm.
and your generator is, say, it's like 5 bits long.
Uh-huh.
If it's not fully, fully divisible to where you're going to get 5 bits as the remainder, do you need to add the zeros?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So that's a fine question. So in doing the CRC computation, right, you divide the generator 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bits into the message, however long it is, to which you have appended how many zeros? This is our message, however many bits. How does this process work? Append 4 zeros, right? Because that's going to be the remainder. That's where the remainder is going to come from. You're going to end up with a remainder of 4 bits if you use a generator of 5 bits. Right? That's the way it works in polynomial division. You end up with a remainder of up to 4 bits. If you only get one coming back.
Well, if it goes in per
Oh, if it goes in perfect, if this goes in perfectly to this, you end up down here with a remainder of zero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't put 4 extra zeros. You said you're putting
4. In doing the division, you start with the message with 4 extra zeros on the end. Okay? So that when you're right, so then you end up down here with say. All right, and then to check, you take from the receiver's perspective, he takes M, and he tacks on this and does the generation by the polynomial, or by the does the division by the generator polynomial.
And you just point out you always put 4 zeros by polynomial. Isn't the leading coefficient how many zeros you put? So if that was 6 digits, it'd be 5 zeros.
If the generator were 6 digits, 6 bits long, it would be 5 zeros. Yeah, it depends on how many bits are in the generator. Right? And
10101031.
10101. No, it's the number of bits, not the number of one bits. It's the number of bits in the generator minus one. Okay, so this is 5 bits, so that's 4 bits. If this were 6 bits, that would be 5 bits. Right. Length of the generator minus 1. Others? Okay. So I will see you a week from Monday, but you'd better be here this Monday. That's right, it would not work. Because remember, there's no carrying or borrowing here in this form of division, right? This is what I objected to in the book. They called it binary division. It's not binary division.
That's why I got confused.
Right.
Because I kept getting two different answers and I wasn't sure which one was
good. Right. So it's what you get when you just do XOR. Essentially, it's XOR between the bits in each column. No carry.
I mean, you don't. It just passes down.
It just passes down. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. If anybody has assignments to turn in, I'll take them, but I don't have to have them now.
Some real quick questions about the project.
Uh-huh.
So I guess the first one is I'm having troubles, and this is because I think I'm just, lack experience in Linux.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to, I've kind of downloaded the Yobu or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I'm having problems trying to launch, a separate, I think it's like a job or like
a separate shell in each one?
In each one, because, you can't execute concurrently, obviously, when I'm trying to test my program. Instead, you're supposed to execute them so that they're all running in parallel. And I'm
right.
That.
Okay.
Is there a simple? I'm assuming there's some command. I just can't find it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's exit. So we run Biobu.
Okay.
Okay. And it looks like
exactly like that. Yeah. Yeah.
It looks like this. Okay. And that's so far so good. And then you do what is it? Control A, capital S, and it splits.
Okay. All right.
So now we have two shells.
And you have the two shells, and you can transfer to in between the
back and forth using control A tab, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But what you don't have yet is you don't have a shell running in the second one. And that's control A C.
Okay.
Okay. And now you've got two different shells.
And then I can in each one.
And each one you can
now,
run whatever
first. If I'm trying to write a shell script to automatically generate
all of the jobs.
Is that
so you need a Biobu configuration script to do that.
Okay.
And so you need to look up how you do that.
Okay.
But you can definitely launch all of these at once.
Okay.
From the BioBoo configuration.
Awesome. So that's right. Look at. And then the second question I have is, and this is just kind of when we're going to our whole to make sure I'm structuring this right. You have.
Okay. Thanks.
You have an entire set of routers, and then do you have one like? Are you like the main controlling thing is you? Are you have a separate connection to each router? So do you have like a separate program that is essentially running that has a link, a UDP link to every single router, and that's what sends, you know, the commands.
Actually, the way it's implemented is that there's not a continuously running such program, but rather you just run that little Python script each time, and it talks to the router and sends that message and goes away.
So it sends a message to a specific router.
Yeah, it just sends us.
So how does it know? So the Python script, it gets like the router name. It doesn't need like the IP address or something like that.
That's right. It gets the router name.
Oh, and the
router's file. It knows.
Gotcha.
Everything.
That makes sense to me. So then it just automatically. So that automatically makes a connection to it.
It does.
And
it does. Well, it doesn't. It actually doesn't make a connection, but it sends a UDP datagram.
Okay.
Without making a connection.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's really helpful information. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
One quick question on this part, on the CRC checking.
Uh huh.
I always thought that this was the remainder up here in red.
No, the remainder is down at the bottom.
Then I only got 100 as the remainder.
Zero one zero zero.
0100?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense now. I'm not a stupid person.
Well, if you've never been told, you may not know, right?
Just one more. It's two extra columns, which could be...